Greetings and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for July 16th, 2010. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, genetic variants associated with kidney disease, finding data-driven approaches to improving PhD training, sharing social responsibility with companies, and bringing science to schools in Washington, D.C. All this plus our usual wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
First up today, explaining susceptibilities to kidney disease. For years, scientists have tried to figure out why African Americans are more prone to kidney disease than Americans of European descent. Now, a paper published online by Science suggests that the answer may lie in two variants of a gene that are common in African genomes but absent from European chromosomes. Those same genetic variants, interestingly, also seem to confer resistance to another disease, African sleeping sickness. Science podcast host Robert Frederick spoke to one of the paper's corresponding authors, Martin Pollack, from his office at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center at Harvard Medical School. Here's Martin Pollack.
It's long been observed that, certainly in the United States, African Americans have much more kidney disease than individuals of European descent, on the order of 4 to 5-fold more kidney disease. In essence, this paper shows that this increased risk of kidney disease can be attributed to coding genetic variants in the APOL1 gene, and that individuals who've inherited two of these coding variants, one on the allele inherited from mom and one on the allele inherited from dad, are at about tenfold risk of developing kidney disease. And what we found particularly interesting is that we can make a connection between this and parasitic disease in Africa. APOL1 is able to lyse certain forms of the parasite known as trypanosomes. There are different subspecies of trypanosomes, and the trypanosome subspecies called trypanosome brucei rhodiens, I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing this right, is normally resistant to being lysed by APOL1. But when APOL1 has either of these two variants, these kidney disease-associated variants in it, APOL1 now is able to lyse the trypanosome. So what we think is going on is that APOL1 evolved this different form in parts of Africa, making it able to protect the people who had these variants against essentially African sleeping sickness infection.
That's what's caused by the trypanosomes.
Exactly. And I think the strongest evidence that there might be evolutionary pressure acting on these variants is the fact that we see such a strong biological difference when we do these. I say we, but it's Etienne Pays in Belgium. His group did these assays and found this rather remarkable difference. And this is true when he does the assays with either purified proteins, with or without these variants, or when he takes plasma from patients with or without these different genotypes. So it's a pretty clear-cut difference. And then when we use certain statistical tests that population geneticists have developed to look at sort of statistical signatures of selection, we see that the haplotypes that contain these two variants harbor signatures of selection. So it's consistent with this notion that there are evolutionary reasons that in Africa there was pressure for these alleles to increase in frequency.
Is this dominant or recessive?
What we think is that resistance to infection is likely dominant. The kidney disease susceptibility is recessive. Now, I should add that it may be the case that there are other parasites that are also impacted by these variants. There is a little bit of a inconsistency between distribution of trypanosome infection and these genotypes. And what really needs to be done is a much more detailed population survey looking at different African populations and the genotype frequencies and comparing these with parasitic infection rates in various regions of Africa as, I think, an important follow-up study.
So you and your team looked at data both from Africans and from African Americans?
We used sequence data from the Thousand Genomes Project, sequence data from Africans. We reasoned that the alleles that were going to be causing this susceptibility to kidney disease were going to be alleles that had very different frequencies between Africans and Europeans. And our subsequent analysis confirmed this idea. I should mention that when we talk about kidney disease, we looked at kidney disease defined in two different ways. One is kidney disease defined by a particular form of injury called focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, or FSGS. FSGS is a common form of kidney injury that's diagnosed only on kidney biopsy by looking at a piece of tissue. And it's characterized by essentially scarring in some of the filtering units, the glomeruli of the kidney. And FSGS can be kind of an idiopathic disease, something that just happens on its own for not clear reasons. It can be familial, and it can be seen secondary to a bunch of other diseases, including things like HIV infection. So that was our starting place for looking at this. And then we also looked at, in collaboration with our colleagues from Wake Forest University, we looked at end-stage kidney disease. And in the paper we refer to as hypertensive end-stage kidney disease that's been attributed to hypertension, but it's not necessarily really of a clear etiology. And there's considerable overlap between FSGS and hypertensive ESKD. They're just different ways. They're forms of kidney disease that are defined differently, but many people with FSGS develop ESKD, and I think probably a pretty large percentage of the people with what's called hypertensive ESKD actually would have FSGS if we were to do a kidney biopsy in those people.
How does this identification of these mutations fit in with previous studies that look to genetic studies to try to predict kidney disease?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there are a lot of genes which, when mutated, cause or increase susceptibility to kidney disease. You know, the kidney is a pretty complicated organ, and there are a lot of ways in which genes can alter kidney function. So this finding, I think, certainly extends all this previous work. I think that on a population basis, this particular locus and these particular alleles may ultimately account for more kidney disease than a lot of these other genes and mutations, which is part of our group's excitement about this finding.
Will this knowledge at this stage lead to programs for better prevention or perhaps even treatment?
I hope so. You know, I think it's an open question whether making an early diagnosis of susceptibility to kidney disease can or should alter the way we care for patients. You know, at a minimum, I think if someone carried two copies of these risk alleles, we might want to monitor them more closely for high blood pressure and for protein in their urine and be much more vigorous about instituting anti-hypertension therapy early. There are certain classes of drugs that we call, you know, ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers that tend to be very effective at slowing down progression of proteinuric kidney disease. And so these are therapies that we might be quicker to prescribe in these susceptible individuals. And that by itself might make a big difference. Although, you know, it certainly would be, I think, very premature for me to suggest that this should now be implemented as a clinical tool. I think more clinical studies will be needed to verify that notion. The other point I should mention that I think is interesting is that these APOL1 and the other members of this APOL family are genes that are only present in humans and apes. They're not present in all species, as is the case with most genes in our genome. So one of the things that we're toying with is studying this. It's not going to be necessarily easy to make a mouse model of this form of disease. With many disease genes, we can say, oh, we can make a mouse model by knocking out the mouse homolog of that gene, and we'll have a mouse model. Or we can put a point mutation into the homologous gene in mouse. Here we can't do that because mice don't have APOL1. So doing the next set of studies is, you know, these will be fun and challenging experiments.
Martin Pollack, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Martin Pollack of Harvard Medical School is co-corresponding author of a paper on genetic variants associated with increased risk of kidney disease in African Americans. He spoke here with Science's Robert Frederick. You can find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. ask a typical academic about how to improve doctoral education, and more likely than not, you'll get an earful about that particular academic's own experience. But is there a better way to assess the effectiveness of PhD training in the sciences? David Felden thinks so. Indeed, this week in Science's Education Forum section, Felden and two colleagues argue for a shift away from anecdotal reports and toward an approach that uses actual performance data to work to improve PhD education outcomes. Science senior editor Brad Weibel spoke with Felden from his office at the University of Virginia. Here's David Felden.
Tradition and history play a very strong role in determining what doctoral education looks like, what it means to be trained as a researcher. And any university faculty member who you go up and ask about, you know, the best way to train graduate students typically is going to say either, oh, the way that I was trained was fantastic and let me tell you what that was, or the way that I was trained was terrible and let me tell you what we shouldn't do. But what we don't have is a systematically collected set of data that tell us what actually is effective. We haven't had the opportunity to date to look at the development of doctoral students longitudinally over the course of their program, see what different experiences they have, and then measure their subsequent performance against standards that have been developed by members of the discipline that reflect quality, not just at a gross level of did they pass a dissertation or not, but at a finer grained level, looking at the identification and development of individual skills. Basically take an engineering approach where we're using data to make informed changes to a process rather than this tradition of personal insight and personal history being the benchmark.
You allude to some instances in which rubrics have been developed. How do these efforts actually work?
So the first step there is to take an existing instrument and see how well it holds up against a broad cross-section to see if it demonstrates the right psychometric properties, reliability, and so forth, to show that the instrument is actually going to be effective across a broad cross-section of writing and not just writing for a particular assignment within a particular class at a particular university. The second thing that then needs to happen is it needs to be externally validated, where people from outside the group that developed the rubric, that hopefully represent people of some expertise and prestige within a scholarly community, can take a look at it, try it out for themselves, look at examples of what scored well and what didn't score as well, and basically provide an outside opinion that this is something that does do a good job at reflecting the values and the priorities of the scholarly field. The other thing that we can start to look for is innovation within a student's work. And we actually can fairly reliably identify when people are taking existing findings and then extending effectively to identify new questions to be asked.
Any lessons that we can learn from the international context?
Well, one of the lessons that we can definitely learn is to look, for instance, at the Bologna process that's ongoing in Europe right now, where they're trying to create a system by which they can equate schools and establish the relative strength of programs in comparison to one another. And this is a process that's really been problematic because programs can look very different at a given place. They might come out equivalently on the quantitative side once you compute all the different measures of productivity that you'd be interested in. But qualitatively, the areas of specialization or the culture of the department, things like that, would be very, very different. So that's one place where we might draw a lesson. There are also other things that are important, like external evaluators in Australian universities and a tradition of lots of attempts at research around doctoral education coming out of Australia and England that hasn't really been picked up here.
Looking forward, what are some examples that have happened in the U.S. or abroad that can give us some hope or guidance moving forward?
So other promising examples in the article, I cite Barbara Levitt's work, and her project is called Making the Implicit Explicit, is really a wonderful example where she's been working with faculty groups as part of internal self-regarding processes to be more critical and more precise about the ways in which they evaluate student work, specifically the dissertation. And what's powerful about that approach is that it really is taking the scientific standards of research and of measurement that are applied in the natural sciences, as a matter of course, and asking scientists to turn that same lens on their educational practice and to ensure that when they are evaluating quality, that their own estimates are as precise as possible, just as they'd want their measurements in a lab to be as precise as possible. The other piece there is that within any discipline, within any institution, there is a cultural norm. And the standards of these cultural norms are typically not made explicit. There's no handbook to how to communicate effectively at a particular conference or when talking about a particular area of research. And these are the things the graduate students tend to pick up along the way as they get slowly socialized into a process. But by making facets of this explicit rather than implicit, it allows them to learn the rules of the game faster so that they can become productive players sooner.
David Felden of the University of Virginia, talking with Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel about using performance-based data in the study of PhD-level science education. Next, a different approach to corporate altruism. Corporate social responsibility programs are nothing new, of course. Think fair trade coffee at your local coffee bar or a supermarket donating a percentage of sales to a charity. But these programs often seem at odds with the company's bottom line mission. Is there a way to set up a program of corporate altruism that profits the company as well as the object of charity? That's a question explored in a paper in this week's Science, which took the research to an unusual setting.
Well, what we did in order to find this out, we went to a large U.S. theme park.
Ayelet Gnezi of the University of California, San Diego, is the study's lead author.
And we were looking for a product in which marginal costs are relatively very low.
Specifically, the experiment focused on a business selling souvenir photos near a theme park roller coaster ride, a setting that ultimately allowed the experiment to sample the behaviors of more than 100,000 participants. Within that busy setting, some customers were offered the photo for a fixed price of $12.95, while other customers could name their own price for the photo, the same scheme used by the group Radiohead in marketing their album In Rainbows several years ago. But there was another variation. About half of the participants in each pricing group were told that 50% of the sale would go to a nationally recognized charity, while for the other half, there was no expectation of a charitable contribution. For the fixed price group, the behavior of consumers with and without the expectation of a charitable contribution wasn't dramatically different. Where things got interesting was in the pay what you want group. For the group where pay what you want wasn't coupled with a charitable contribution,
pay what you want did not benefit the company in any way in terms of profits. The price at the end of the day converged to the real cost of the product.
In other words, very low price and zero profit. Even though allowing consumers to name their own price led to a substantial increase in the number of photos sold over the fixed price model. But when pay what you want was coupled with a charitable contribution, the picture changed dramatically.
In pay what you want and half goes to charity, the price actually averaged $5.33.
That's less than half the $12.95 cost under the fixed price model. But the profit per photo to the company was almost three times higher under pay what you want plus charity than under fixed price plus charity. Because many, many more people actually purchased the photos. It also, of course, far outran the zero profit performance of the program in which consumers could pay what they wanted without the charity component. And that, notes Stefano Della Vigna, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley, who is not affiliated with the study, hinges on the behavior of what he refers to as the cheapskates.
It turns out if the company just do pay what you want, which seems like a generous action, people do purchase a lot more. But the increased sales are largely sales for either zero or very, very small amounts, such that the average price of sale is less than a dollar. And it turns out that if you have pay what you want, but half of the money goes to charity, those cheapskates don't buy, essentially, because the average price at which people purchase is around, I think, a bit in excess of $5. So it means like it's a big difference. So it means that the people that were essentially taking it for free, now they don't want to do that once it's about giving money to charities.
Gnezi says that the people who paid what they wanted with a charitable contribution did indeed show a very different attitude from those who named their own price without a portion going to charity.
People really took this seriously, you know, as seriously as you can get in a theme park, but they really thought about it. It wasn't just, okay, let's get the best deal. So they really cared for the cause, and they really wanted the same time to get some kind of a good deal for the photo. And the average of the $5.33 per photo was the compromise for that.
That compromise between consumer and company, say Ghanizi and her colleagues on the study, may point to a very different approach to corporate altruism, which they call shared social responsibility. In much the same way that companies are increasingly reaching out to customers for input on product design and marketing, they can form similar partnerships to benefit charity at a price that works for both parties.
If the company, the firm, is about doing something good for a certain cause, and if the firm is inviting its customers to take part in that doing, then it should allow the firm to decide to what extent they actually would like to do that.
Of course, the study also raises many questions, one of which is whether this consumer behavior stems from true charitable concern or something else. Here's Stefano Della Vigna.
An interesting question is, do consumers give more when there is a charity destination of the money because they care more? They really feel like, oh, it's a great thing, the money goes to charity, I feel better about this company. Or is it that it's about social pressure? So now all of a sudden they feel, my goodness, if I do not buy that photo, I'm going to look really bad.
The distinction is crucial, says Della Vigna, because if the consumer feels compelled to buy the photo because of social pressure, it could actually lead to negative feelings about the program. And, flipping things around, the consumer's trust of the company's good intentions in these charitable schemes also plays a big role. Again, study author Ayelet Ghanizi.
I don't trust a company and they tell me, you know, you pay whatever you want and I'll donate a percentage of that to charity, I may not trust the company to actually do that. So I'm assuming this is just another way, you know, of making me purchase products.
It also remains to be seen whether the shared social responsibility approach, which worked so well in a souvenir photo operation in an amusement park, could apply as well to businesses with higher marginal costs, such as restaurants or manufacturing. But whatever the question still to be answered, Della Vigna notes that the paper is an example of a growing line of research in economics, one that combines the techniques of controlled laboratory experiment with the real-world perspective possible in an economic field study. He says it's a promising line of research as economists seek to provide real-world value through their science.
One of the things that economists are really working on these days is getting in touch with firms and helping them design more creative and novel ways that hopefully could benefit both the consumers and the companies, and in this case, the charities.
You can read the study on shared social responsibility by Ayelet Ghanizi and her colleagues this week on the Science website, where you'll also find a perspective by Stefano Della Vigna that discusses the study.
Science in the District of Columbia schools is not as good as it should be, and in some cases is not good at all.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports in this week's issue on a new push to get scientists into the public school classrooms in Washington, D.C. He talked with podcast host Robert Frederick about it.
And what students get depends on a lot of factors, including the skills of their teacher, the time that they have to devote to science, and the support they get from the school system.
How often are D.C. students in science class each week?
Well, it depends by level, of course. In elementary school, it's not a core subject, so it's really at the discretion of the principal and, to some extent, the staff. That could be once or twice a week, or that could be not at all. There are some teachers in the elementary school who are science specialists, and they try to do as good a job as they can. But that's the case probably in only about 1 in 10 of elementary schools. For the rest, they avoid it.
And middle or high school level?
At the middle and high school level, you have specific science courses that you sign up for. And in fact, in high school, you're required to take 4 years of science. But of course, the quality of that instruction varies greatly from school to school.
And the students coming to those classes may not be so prepared if they haven't had it.
And right. And the preparation, certainly in math, leaves a lot to be desired in most schools, which makes it harder for high school teachers to be able to teach the subject at the level they would like to.
So where is the focus going if it's not happening in science during elementary school?
Well, in elementary school in D.C., as in everywhere around the country, schools are driven by the current educational law, which emphasizes test scores on reading and math. And so that's where most of the attention is devoted. And I don't think anyone would object to that. Certainly reading and math are very important, but I think the science community and the science educators don't want that to happen at the expense of science. They'd like it to be in addition to.
Is there anyone who oversees science education in the D.C. public schools?
Well, there used to be. There was a head of a science department, but last year in a reorganization, that position was eliminated. And the D.C. school officials say that the responsibility has devolved to the building principals. But most of the teachers that I talked to felt, especially at the elementary level, that they no longer get the support that they would like. They no longer find out about opportunities to collaborate. They no longer find out about training opportunities and supplemental material, and they're pretty much left on their own.
How has the D.C. Schools Administration responded to that call for science, better science expertise at the elementary school level?
Well, one of the programs, a new program that's called Catalyst Schools, is supposed to provide an opportunity to emphasize science, but it is focused on the lowest performing schools in the hope that they will use science as an organizing principle to attract students and to give parents a reason to send their kids to school. That program, though, hasn't gotten underway yet. Teachers are still being trained, and the goal is to have all the teachers learn enough science to be able to teach it.
And how about the scientific community in and around D.C.? How are they responding?
Well, this has given an opportunity for all the scientific organizations that are in the Washington area to try to link up with the schools. And there are lots of organizations that do that, some that have been doing that for decades. There's also a new push nationally called National Lab Day, which is a poor name for what's an ongoing effort to be a matchmaker online between teachers who are looking for expertise and scientists who are interested in providing it, whether it's to lead a field trip or to conduct an experiment in class or to provide materials for teachers who are interested in supplementing the regular curriculum.
And how well is that program working?
Well, that's just getting underway. And again, it was slower to get underway in D.C. than many parts of the country because teachers are busy. They have lots of things that they have to focus on, and they either weren't aware of or didn't have the time that it took to establish those kind of collaborations. And that's what the program is hoping to foster. But it takes interest by the teachers. It takes support by the school system, and then it takes scientists who are willing and able and capable of coming in and helping.
By capable, do the scientists themselves have to work on the curriculum?
Well, capable can mean a lot of things. In the simplest way, it means taking a senior scientist and putting him or her into a classroom of fourth graders. He or she has to be able to know what those students are capable of understanding, prepare the material, and present it in a way that fits into what the students know. The teacher is always in charge, but the scientist has to realize who his or her audience is.
Now, you said senior scientists. Did you find that primarily older or more established scientists are getting involved, or that younger ones are too?
I think it ranges. You know, typically younger scientists may be so focused on their own research and on getting tenure that they don't have time to do this kind of outreach. But I think a lot of scientists are interested at all ages. It's really a question, I think, of opportunity and knowledge of what's available.
With the reorganization in the D.C. schools, and it sounds like a number of programs beginning, I imagine there's focus or attention towards finding programs that have worked elsewhere. What programs have worked elsewhere where scientists are pairing up with schools?
Well, there's one interesting program that began almost 20 years ago by a neuroscientist at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and it's called Kids Judge. And it spread around universities. And the idea is that instead of having students present their science fair projects to scientists, scientists present it to fourth graders. And the goal is to get scientists to be able to speak in a way that the public can understand, to describe their research, to describe scientific concepts in a very simple and clear fashion. The scientists who do that, some of them with their undergraduate and graduate students, say it's a terrific way for the students to learn how to present their work. And it also gets the kids excited because they see that science is real and they see what it looks like, not just coming in a textbook. But that program has not spread to D.C., I should add, in part because there hasn't been anyone at a local university who's willing to take the first step.
And with no one overseeing science education for the D.C. public schools, it doesn't sound like it's likely that there'll be somebody around to bring in or do research about what other programs are working elsewhere.
Well, it's that much harder. Again, a principal or a teacher has so many things that they have to do that reaching out to find someone at a university who is not only interested but able to provide this kind of partnership isn't easy. You generally need to have some kind of model and somebody who's, you know, stepped forward and is willing to come into your school.
Where are the parents in all of this?
Well, as in most cases, parents who are involved with their students are also involved with their student science education. And schools in wealthier neighborhoods can tap into that expertise that their parents have. Schools in poorer districts don't have that kind of community support, and they don't have the parental support.
Are the parents and the students who live in these wealthier areas primarily going to private schools, or are they actually in the public system?
Well, both. The district has a large number of charter schools. Almost 40% of the student body in the District of Columbia goes to charter schools, which are publicly financed but operate under their own rules. And then there are the traditional private and parochial schools as well. But there are many parental groups that are active in the public schools.
Are there any barriers from the institutions that scientists work at that would prevent them from participating in such collaborations with schools?
I think the biggest barrier is an institutional culture at their university that might frown upon this kind of educational outreach. I think most universities encourage it in theory, but in practice, a lot of scientists say they have to do it in addition to or on top of what they're expected to do in the lab. The ones that are committed to it, I think, find time and also find the justification for doing this kind of outreach. I think one of the things that I learned in the story is that collaboration isn't easy, but it's worthwhile when you do it. And the schools and the teachers and the students appreciate it. But there are some high barriers that you may need to overcome when you're thinking about it before you can actually plunge in.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports in this week's issue on a new push to get scientists into the public school classrooms in Washington, D.C. He was interviewed by Robert Frederick. You can find the article, along with a number of additional online-only features, at www.sciencemag.org/extra/DC-schools. Well, finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with a few notable stories from our daily news site. First, David, a new vaccine that's seriously cool, and I guess that's not just hyperbole.
No, that's true, Stuart. The reason they're calling it a cool vaccine is because it's actually based on bacteria that live in the polar regions of the Earth. And what's interesting about these bacteria is because they grow in such cold environments, they could actually die if you put them in a warmer environment like our body, and that's because their enzymes are really suited to working at these cold temperatures. And if you heat the bacteria up too much or a lot hotter than they're used to, these enzymes stop working and the bacteria die. Now, the reason researchers are interested in these bacteria is because when researchers try to develop vaccines, a lot of times they'll use pieces of viruses or pieces of bacteria to help stimulate the body's immune response. Sometimes they'll even use whole viruses and bacteria. But the problem with using these whole organisms, as it were, is that you don't want to be putting live organisms in your body if they could cause problems.
Right.
So the idea with the cold bacteria is you would put the bacteria in your body, the body would respond to it because the bacteria are there, but the bacteria would quickly die or would only live in the cold parts of your body where it couldn't spread to places where it could do damage.
Well, that sounds good in principle. What do you do to actually test this?
So what the researchers did here is they started out with a relative of a bacteria that actually causes problems in humans. This bacteria has actually been classified as a bioweapon, and they took a relative of this bacteria, and this is a bacteria that grows at our body temperature. What they did is they took out a few essential genes in this bacteria, genes that this bacterium needs to live, and they inserted analogous genes from these really cold bacteria. And what they ended up with was this genetically modified bacteria that resembles a bacteria that can do us harm, but that can't really survive in the body because it's got these proteins that can only work at low temperatures.
And then they put this into a living system and just saw what happened?
Exactly. And they didn't use people. That wouldn't really be ethical. But what they did was they took rats and they injected bacteria into the tails of rats. And what's notable about the tails of rats is that these tails are actually cooler than the rest of the rat's body. So these bacteria could survive in the tails. But usually what happens is when these bacteria move into other parts of the body, like the lungs or the heart, that's where they cause their damage. But these bacteria didn't do that in the rats because these parts of the body were a lot warmer and the bacteria couldn't survive there. And so what happened was these bacteria just sort of hung out in the tails of the rats where they weren't causing damage, but they were still in the rat's body. So the rats mounted an immune response against these bacteria that protected them when the researchers tried to cause a disease related to these bacteria in the rats a few weeks down the line. The bottom line was that you could inject these relatively harmless bacteria into the rats, immunize the rats, but the bacteria weren't going to cause any problems.
Well, you know, rodents are all well and good, but what does this mean for the rest of us?
Well, this definitely seems to could have applications for humans. The researchers talk about tuberculosis. There's a tuberculosis vaccine that's been around for a long time and is actually not terribly effective. And they say if we can modify the pathogen that causes tuberculosis with these cold enzymes, maybe we could create a much more effective vaccine. But there's still safety concerns. The problem with bacteria is they tend to mutate very quickly. So even if you put a bacteria in your body that's only supposed to grow at cold temperatures, there's a chance it could develop mutations that would allow it to survive at much warmer temperatures. And then you've got the same problems you would have with a normal bacteria.
So still some work to be done.
Exactly.
But speaking of microbes, you've got another story about all the unique viruses in my personal gut. What can you tell me about that?
Well, that's right, Stuart. This next story is all about all of the different kinds of viruses that live in our intestines, something we probably don't like to think about. But it turns out that we already knew that there are billions of bacteria living in our gut. There's actually more bacteria in our gut than there are cells in our gut. And researchers knew that there were viruses in there too, what they call phages. And these are viruses that don't really attack us. They attack bacteria. But they wanted to figure out if everybody has a unique viral signature. We know that everybody actually has a unique bacterial signature. You and I, even though we have lots of bacteria in our guts, the bacteria that you and I have are actually very different. Researchers want to see if the same is true for these phages. And so what they did, which is kind of disgusting, is that they took fecal samples from four sets of Missouri-born female identical twins and their mothers. And they purified these samples. They actually took samples over the course of the year because they wanted to see, do these viral communities change over time? They sequenced the viruses they got out of this poop, as it were. And what they found was that just like bacteria, each person had their own unique viral signature. Even identical twins had very different kinds of viruses living in their respective guts. And it was actually much different than what the researchers saw from bacteria. With bacteria, identical twins share about 50% of the same bacteria. But with viruses, there was very little overlap, meaning that even people that are very closely related have very different populations of viruses in their gut.
So it's almost like a viral gut print.
It's like a viral fingerprint for your gut.
So what explains all this?
That's a really good question. Researchers really don't know, A, where these viruses are coming from, or B, why they are so diverse, although they suspect that there's just so many different kinds of these viruses out there that just statistically, even if you got people that are closely related, there's just so many different kinds of these viruses that you're just not going to have the same viral fingerprint from person to person. There's just too much diversity. And beyond that, the researchers are hoping that, you know, when we look at what's happening in our guts, not just the guts themselves, but actually what's living in there, like viruses and bacteria, they can actually give a bit of a clue to the health of our gut. So they're hoping that this research isn't just sort of a fun, hey, we've all got different viruses in our guts, but it actually might have some applications to human health down the line.
Okay, great. And finally, getting out of the microbial realm, why gorillas play tag. First, David, just what is a game of tag when you're a gorilla?
Well, Stuart, it's actually surprisingly similar to what you would see with children playing tag. What researchers have observed gorillas doing in zoos and reserves and wildlife reserves is that sometimes a gorilla will sneak up on another gorilla, pull his hair or hit him, and then run away, sometimes with his mouth open. And then sometimes the other gorilla will give chase and sometimes not. You can actually see a video of this on the site. And often this first gorilla, when that round is done, will come back and do the same thing again. And it's very much like a game of tag, like tagged you, run away, and then do it again. So researchers are wondering, why are they doing this? Is this just sort of them playing around? I mean, we know animals play. Is it just a regular play behavior, or does it have deeper implications?
And so did researchers go in and start tagging gorillas?
they didn't. But what they did was they studied 3 years of video of gorillas at various zoos and reserves in places in Germany and Switzerland. And they looked at a lot of this tagging behavior. And they noticed some patterns. And one of the patterns they noticed was that the tagger tended to be a lower status gorilla than the taggee. Gorilla society is a bit of a hierarchy. You've got your alpha gorillas and you've got gorillas that are sort of lower down on the totem pole, as it were. And what the researchers were seeing was that these lower status gorillas were usually the ones that were hitting the other gorillas and running away. And the reason they think that's significant is because there's a big question about whether non-human animals can sense fairness. You know, does a dog know when you're being fair to him and not his sister, for example? And they think they've seen this a little bit in monkeys in laboratory experiments, but this really hasn't been tested in a more natural setting. And that's what's happening that's what they're doing with the gorillas here. And the reason I bring up unfairness is the researchers think the reason that these lower status gorillas are slapping these higher status gorillas and running away is because it's their one chance to say, look, I know I'm low status, but I'm going to hit you and get away with it. That's not something I can do in real life, but in the context of this game, I can do that.
So they can tweak the higher ups without getting into serious trouble.
Without repercussions, exactly. And that actually even has larger implications because what it says is the gorillas have a sense of the social constructs of their society. They have some sort of sense of there's gorillas on the top and there's gorillas on the bottom, and they feel this inequity, especially if they're one of those gorillas on the bottom, and this is their way to try to make up for it, or at least get a temporary ego boost. So it's all plays into this idea that animals, non-human animals, can sense unfairness, and especially in the gorilla's case, they're actually doing something about it.
Okay, great. Well, what other stories are you looking into this week on the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how diamonds can reveal where volcanoes are going to form, and also a story about a malaria-proof mosquito. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we continue our very extensive oil spill coverage. We've got a story this week about an expert committee that's being formed to figure out exactly what caused the rig explosion and why the oil spill started in the first place. And we've also got a story from Science Insider about a new journal that's been launched that's taking very wacky papers. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Wacky papers. David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news in the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the July 16th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.